Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order this morning, Friday. Committee, we're going to get started here pretty quickly. We're going to have to recess at 8:30 to go to floor for 10 or 15 minutes or so, and then we'll be reconvene right after that and hopefully get our work done by 10-ish. So with that, I'm going to start out with opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 552A.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure establishes workplace protections for certain domestic workers, including overtime pay, periods of rest, paid vacation time, and freedom from harassment. Directs BOLI to adopt implementation rules, classifies that violations are an unlawful employment practice. There are no amendments. Senate vote on this measure was 26-4. There's no revenue impact. There's a minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you. Good morning, Senator. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, which includes Corvallis and Albany and all the areas around that. I'm really happy to bring you today Senate Bill 552, which passed the Senate with broad bipartisan support. It also passed the House 2 years ago with broad bipartisan support. So this is the little bill that could that keeps coming back. This bill is a little bit different than what it was when you voted on it last time, so I just want to describe exactly what it does. It's also a little bit different than the measure summary. Most significantly, the bill does not talk about overtime. That was removed in a Senate amendment. Okay. Nope, I'm wrong. Take it back. It was not, because that's part of federal law. So this bill does a couple of things. For workers that live in, if we pass this bill, it will say that if you have a nanny or a housekeeper, and this only applies to nannies and housekeepers, does not apply to people that care for elderly or disabled people, in every 24-hour period, they have to be allowed to sleep. There just has to be an 8-hour period within each 24-hour period and that they have the time off. You don't have to make them sleep, but they have to have the opportunity to sleep once a day. The bill also says that if your nanny or housekeeper lives with you once in every 7-day period, they need to have 24 consecutive hours of rest. So one day off each week, not paid, and the opportunity to sleep once a day. The bill also says that if your nanny or housekeeper lives with you, they have to be able to eat the food that is consistent with their health or religious or dietary restrictions. There is an exemption in the bill that says that modifications, of course, can be made for the religious or health needs of the employer family. So, for instance, if there's a child that is severely allergic to peanuts, you could require that the person not bring peanut products into the home. If you keep a kosher kitchen, you could, you know, allow your worker to prepare their own food, but require that they assist you in maintaining a kosher kitchen and not bring things that would break your kosher your kitchen. The bill also does two other things that are really important for live-in workers. One, it ensures that worker has the right to hold their own passport. The employer cannot request or require that they take possession of that worker's passport as a condition of employment. And finally, our state and federal law explicitly exclude domestic workers, including nannies and housekeepers, from protections from discrimination and sexual harassment. So this bill explicitly says that you may not subject your employee to sexual harassment. You cannot ask them for unwanted sexual favors. They would be protected as all others are. The language, the way that we did that, we just reinserted that language in here rather than removing the exemption in that definition of employee in the statute so as to keep this very narrow. There are other employment issues that domestic workers are exempted from. For example, in Oregon, domestic workers are eligible for the federal minimum wage, but they are not eligible for the state minimum wage. This bill does not bring these workers up to the state minimum wage. They still are at that federal minimum wage. So the overtime protection that's referenced in this bill, we kept it in there as a really kind of as a reminder, under federal law, they are eligible for that, but it's time and a half based on their wage or the federal minimum wage, not on the Oregon minimum wage. For workers that don't live in the home, the provisions that apply are those sexual harassment provisions and the passport provision. For both those that work in and out of the home, after they have been in your employ for a year, if they have worked at least an average of 30 hours a week, they would be entitled to some paid time off at the end of that year. But that would not include someone that just coming a couple of hours a week. They would have had to maintain for an entire year an average of 30 hours per week. That pretty much is it. Again, the scope is very narrow in terms of who this applies to. It is only individuals that the employer is providing a W-2 to. So if you have hired someone that comes to your house and cleans a couple hours every other week and they're an independent contractor, they're not covered by this bill. They're only covered if you are their employer and you're providing them a W-2. We added a couple of other exemptions as well. It doesn't apply to the child of an employer who's under the age of 26. So your daughter lives with you and is also your nanny. These protections don't apply to you. Doesn't apply to people that are babysitters that provide babysitting services on a casual basis, or anybody under the age of 18 who provides babysitting services to any child, regardless of their relationship to the parent, if they're under 14 years of age, any casual labor related to maintenance of the exterior of the house. It also does not apply to house sitting services or to swapping services, like I'll clean your house if you wash my horse. That is not covered. Again, it's only if you give the W-2, but we wanted to be extremely explicit as we went through that. A lot of people have worked on this bill. I'm particularly grateful to Senator Knope, who helped really refine this, and you'll see that at the end he ended up signing on as a chief co-sponsor of the bill. Finally, the bill is important because these are very vulnerable individuals, partly because people have great affection for the people that work in their homes as nannies and housekeepers. That can actually create a pretty high level of vulnerability. The other issue that we discussed on the Senate floor, and the reason I became interested in this topic in the first place, this is a workforce in which human trafficking is hidden, where people are illegally brought to the country and work in very demeaning circumstances and have no way to access help. This bill is important in that way because the way the bill is structured, these are the requirements of the employer rather than drafted necessarily as rights of the employee. So this applies to anybody that you are employing. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Doherty.
The one question I had, and I think it was the same question I asked last time, how many people are actually affected, would be affected by this? I've never known anyone that's had live-in help. So I assume there's an estimate as to how many we have.
Chair Holvey, Representative Doherty, and again, this is the live-in help and people that aren't living in that are getting that W-2, mm-hmm. But the estimates that we had, it was several thousand people.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Representative Barreto.
Yeah, I had a couple. One, you had mentioned that the employer is responsible for basically giving them the food that they require for whatever reason. And I was just wondering if they didn't comply, if they didn't want to comply with that, would there be recourse from that employee towards the employer if they didn't feel like they wanted to feed them that particular food that they needed or desired, if they were vegetarian or if they didn't like peanuts or whatever? So,
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, thank you for that question. It's an important clarification. This does not require the employer to provide the food. The language is, if the domestic worker lives in the home of the employer, permit the domestic worker to cook the domestic worker's own food. Okay. So the domestic worker would purchase the food, prepare the food. It's just that ability to prepare their own food.
Okay. Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
So then also, you said they would fall under federal minimum wage, and if they worked a 624, is that those number of hours that they would have to be paid that minimum wage for whatever 6 times 24 is per week, you know, would they be required to pay them for every hour that they were in the house?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, it is, so for a live-in housekeeper, nanny, it would be 44 hours a week of of work, and there are both state and federal rules that define which time is counted as work time. Duty-free time is not counted as work time, so not every hour that they're living in the home would toll towards that. It would be the actual amount of time.
And one more follow-up.
Go ahead.
As far as lodging, food and lodging, if the employer, the family, provided food and lodging, is that a negotiating tool with them as far as wages, or is that required to be included in the job description?
Chair Holby, Representative Bredo, that's actually not addressed in this bill. The bill doesn't change any of the pay requirements that are in here. It just clarifies. I think many people that are employing these workers don't. A lot of this happens under the table, and people aren't aware of what federal requirements exist. For instance, the original version of this bill last time required that there be a written contract and a written statement of hours. That's actually existing federal law today. So this bill doesn't change any of those things.
Thank you.
And just following up on Representative Barreto's question about the federal minimum wage, so why aren't these workers subject to state minimum wage? Or why can't they be?
Chair Holdy, members of the committee, certainly the legislature could choose to make them eligible for the state minimum wage. I know there are advocates for this bill that are disappointed that this bill doesn't go far enough in terms of applying that state minimum wage to these workers. It didn't seem politically feasible, and I think the other protections that were in here were important. The reason that they're not subject is in the definition of employer, of employee, domestic workers are explicitly excluded. So any place in the statute that talks about the responsibilities between an employer and an employee, it does not apply to a domestic worker unless we have proactively stated that responsibility someplace else in legislation. And that is the reason why, for example, the sexual harassment needs to be added in. And that's the place where, if you remember in the original presentation, I said we address these issues by stating them in a section of statute rather than removing that exemption from that definition of employer. And I think that is a policy discussion that I would be very interested in having in a future session. But this bill today, I think these basic issues for these vulnerable workers, the ability to sleep, the ability to eat the food that is appropriate, the ability to have protection from sexual harassment, makes this bill worth passing, maybe today, even if it doesn't do everything that I might like.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Were there other questions? Representative Evans, last question.
First of all, I really appreciate this bill. My question is, have you had conversations with the congressional delegation about why that federal exemption is there?
Representative Holvey, Representative Evans, I have not personally had conversations with them. I know Family Forward Oregon in their presentations on this bill over the last couple of sessions have given kind of a historic overview. I mean, domestic workers, if you go back decades and decades, really come from a time when we mistreated people as servants and frankly as slaves, domestic work.
Right.
And it's an issue. Some of these things have been taken up by the Department of Labor and federal Department of Labor rules around people that work in homes, but it's a very difficult thing to untangle. It's a very emotional issue for a lot of people, but one that I think sorely needs to be addressed at the federal level. Right now, fortunately, we have the ability to do something at
right.
the state level, and hopefully we can keep moving forward.
Just a follow-up question or comment. I applaud you for doing this, and when this passes, which I hope is soon, if you could carry that message. It seems like Congress has not been watching this for some time and needs to get it fixed because it's embarrassing right now.
Happy to do so. Thank you, Representative Evans.
And thank you, as my great-grandmother worked in servitude as a nanny in Colorado many moons ago, and it's an interesting story, and it seems like our laws have not kept pace. So I appreciate you bringing this forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There was no one else signed up for Senate Bill 552. I'm going to close the. Was there anybody else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 552?
Okay.
Good. You're not going to do it now.
Okay.
I will close. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 552. We'll reopen it after a little bit. Somebody's got some time constraints I wanted to get taken care of here. And that bill is, let me open a public hearing on Senate Bill 470.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure permits school employees who do not provide instructional research or principal administrative services to receive unemployment insurance benefits during summer and school breaks if they terminate employment for good cause. There's provisions found if it's out of conformity with federal law that it will no longer be in effect. Declares an emergency. There are no amendments.
And I won't call up Tricia Smith because she doesn't seem to be here, but I'd like to call up the Employment Department, David Gerstenfeld.
Thank you, Chair Hovey, members of the committee. For the record, David Gerstenfeld, Unemployment Insurance Administrator at the Employment Department, and appreciate you letting me testify now because of the time constraints. Senate Bill 478 deals with some specific unemployment insurance provisions that apply to people who work for schools. We call them the school recess laws, and they're pretty technical, but the bottom line is they ultimately result in most school employees not getting benefits during breaks between academic terms or years. So that means school employees generally cannot get unemployment over winter break, spring break, and importantly, the longer summer break period. There are some federal requirements around this. If we stray from those federal requirements, the consequences can be pretty significant. One, the state could lose its unemployment insurance administrative grant, which is about $100 million a year. That's what we use to operate the unemployment insurance program. And importantly, Oregon employers can lose a tax credit that they receive against their federal unemployment insurance tax obligation, and that's estimated to be about $1 billion per biennium in additional employer payroll obligations if we stray from those federal requirements. There are two categories of employees that the school recess laws apply to. There's what they call the instructional employees, people that teach, do research and administration. There really is very little leeway there. This committee heard testimony earlier in the session about House Bill 3508, which dealt with some of those instructional employees. For those employees, it's required that the school recess provisions apply. There's another category, which is basically everyone else, the non-instructional employees. Starting in the early 90s, the federal government said that states could opt to not have the school recess provisions apply to those non-instructional employees. Originally, they said it was an all or nothing. You either had the provisions apply or not. Since then, they've said that there are some limited ways that you can carve out exceptions. So Senate Bill 470, as originally introduced, would have completely removed the school recess provisions from applying to non-instructional employees. So that's something that was fine from a federal conformity perspective. There were concerns about the financial impact on the schools as employers. Most schools reimburse dollar for dollar for any unemployment insurance benefits paid. As a result of the discussions about that financial impact, the version that you have before you now, the Engross version, came about. That was basically not eliminating all non-instructional employees, but carving out a little exception. And the exception was for people that quit their job but had a good reason to do so, so they were getting unemployment benefits. And under current law, what happens is those people can get benefits until a break period hits, and then they stop receiving benefits. So if I quit in April and I get unemployment insurance benefits, when mid-June hits, if that's when the school recess for my former employer starts, I'm going to stop receiving unemployment unless I'm still unemployed when the next school year starts. So the version that you have before you would have stopped that. The challenge is that the Department of Labor has since this passed from the Senate side, informed us that they do not believe that that is consistent with the federal requirements. They only allow exceptions to be carved out based on the type of work duties being performed. So, for instance, we could say that for non-instructional employees, bus drivers aren't covered by the school recess laws or cooks, but that's really the way that they let you carve out exceptions. There had been discussions on the Senate side about another amendment also that would have made a different exception. So it would have said that people that work for the schools year-round were not covered by these school recess laws. And again, that's something that the Department of Labor has told us they don't think is consistent with federal law. So we've been in discussion with the bill proponents. We think that this is something, there's been a lot of interest over the years about how the school recess laws apply. So there's been House Bill 3508 and this bill this session. There have been similar bills in prior sessions. We're certainly willing to work with all the stakeholders to try to work through what's possible, what the federal government would allow within those federal frameworks. But that's something that, the current version of the bill would violate the conformity requirements.
Thank you for that very thorough explanation of the bill. And we have about 2 minutes left. So, Tricia, would you like to provide us some thoughts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, a public and private sector union that represents predominantly classified the non-instructional employees that David was just referring to. I apologize for my lack of timeliness this morning. I certainly wish it could have been avoided. I would first like to put in context who these folks are. These are the people who are the lunch lady, which sounds great and sounds like somebody that's going to hug you and you know they will, but they're also professionals who have to understand commercial food handling requirements and how to safely provide food to hundreds of children every day. They're the instructional assistants who are assisting teachers with our students each day, and they are professionals, many of them. You will see in your OLIS 37 different pieces of testimony from classified school employees telling you how they are affected by the fact that they work somewhere around 180 to 210 days a year, much less, about 70 to 80% of a normal work year. They don't get paid vacation, and they don't get unemployment when their employer shuts down, unlike every other classification of employee that there is. David may have mentioned that they were initially considered and maybe still considered seasonal employees, and when unemployment laws were first written, seasonal employees were not included. The federal government and the states, though, looked at that as a potential for employers to have the government subsidize their employment by providing unemployment, by not providing unemployment insurance. So seasonal employees have come into the fold bit by bit over the years. The last group are school employees. These are people who are predominantly, there was testimony on the Senate side from Sydney Meyer from Corvallis School District. She is a fiscal clerk there. 80% of the classified employees in Corvallis have at least a 2-year college degree. And they want to do the work they're doing, but it is extremely difficult for them to continue with this employment when they have no income in the summer. Can you imagine what your life would be like if you did not have income 75% of the work year? It is a very difficult thing to do. It's also very difficult for them to supplement that employment with additional employment during the summer because employers are looking for someone that's going to stay, not someone that's going to be there 40 days and then leave. So this is a crisis, not just for our members, but it costs, it's estimated, for example, that it costs the Corvallis School District about $45,000 a year just in turnover costs for the 20% of classified that turnover every year because they can't stay because of this. So we don't expect this bill to pass, but we do hope that you will allow us to delve into this in a better way. It's a problem not just for the 30,000 people who are personally affected, but for our schools and for our state. And we would like the opportunity to work with the department to try to figure out how we can make this so, as we also work for a stable and adequate revenue stream that would support it. And when that happens, when those pieces fall in place, we'll be back. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And we're running out of time. I know we could talk about this subject quite a while. We had a previous bill on this subject for instructional folks and running the same sort of issues with the U.S. Department of Labor Committee. It's my intention to have a formal work group or perhaps a task force on this during the interim and try to get the stakeholders from the school districts and the instructional folks, classified, and the employment department. Hopefully we can engage the department, U.S. Department of Labor, along the way to see if we can come up with some better solutions here. So that will be my intent on this going forward, but appreciate you bringing this issue forward, and thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 470A, and we are going to recess at this point and reconvene shortly after floor, which I expect to be about 15 minutes. So with that, we stand in recess. I'd like to reconvene the House Committee on Business and Labor, and we will open a public hearing on, reopen a public hearing on Senate Bill 552A. Jan, do you just want to remind us that this is the bill about
domestic workers? Yes, thank you, Jan. Okay. This is the bill about domestic workers.
Great. Kate Newell, please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, and I'm here today representing Family Forward Oregon. We are happy to be here today in support of Senate Bill 552 and believe that it provides a very basic measure of protection for domestic workers. Domestic workers are some of the most vulnerable workers in our state and country, and an overwhelming 95% of those domestic workers are women. They do a job. They provide care for our family members that requires complex skills, a great deal of compassion, and often very, very long hours. We're here today to support Senate Bill 552 so that these workers do have some protections to a break and to overtime and protection from sexual harassment. I will say, even though we're happy to be here supporting 552, I think you heard before you some of the ways that domestic workers are still excluded from Oregon wage and hour law and minimum wage and our meal and rest period protections. I think the protections that are in Senate Bill 552 are very important to add for these domestic workers. I also think they're not the same protections that are available for every other worker in Oregon under our current wage and hour law. So with that said, we are happy to support 552. I think it is a step towards making sure that these workers that care for our families are protected. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Newell? Not seeing it. Thank you very much for adding your voice to this important bill. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 552A and open a work session on Senate Bill 552A.
Chair Holvey, I move Senate Bill 552A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 552A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Not seeing you. Matthew, can you call the roll, please?
Representative Barreto?
No.
Representative Dougherty?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Excused.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Excused.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kennemer?
Aye.
Chair Holvey?
Aye. Senate Bill 552A, having received the votes, it's passed. Carrier? Volunteer?
Sure. Okay. I will.
Representative Nose?
She can do it.
No, he can. I was literally for a second. I thought, Representative Gelser will rock paper.
We won't argue about it too much longer. Representative Nose, carry the bill. We'll close right. Work session on Senate Bill 552A.
I forgot she used to be a rep. She was in the House last session, so my first thought was, well, Representative Gelser will want to be a bistro for
dinner. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 370A.
Committee members, this measure allows certain death benefits available to members of PERS and other public employee retirements to be paid to a former spouse as provided in a judgment of annulment, dissolution of marriage, or separation. It adds a provisions to address the divisions between the member's spouse and former spouse, specifies when the public employer must provide retirement benefits to the former spouse and or to dependent child in the event of the member's death, It limits application of the benefits of the member who dies on or after the effective date, declares an emergency. There are no amendments, and the bill came over from the Senate on a vote of 21-7.
Thank you.
Oh.
And coming up to testify, we have Steve Rodeman, Ryan Cardi, and Deb Lush. Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Cardi. I'm a lawyer in private practice here in Salem. My practice is limited to issues involving family law. I'm here today, however, in my official capacity as the legislative liaison for the family law section of the Oregon State Bar. This is my third session in that capacity. I am the current chair of the legislative section, legislative subcommittee of the family law section of the Oregon State Bar. And Senate Bill 370 comes to you on behalf of the family law section and is legislation we have proposed to fix what we believe is a hole in the law here in Oregon. And let me pose it to you in this fashion. If you have an OPSRP member, that member, once vested, has an entitlement to a survivor benefit for a spouse. If that member then is divorced, the court can divide and either award that survivor benefit or not. The court has that discretion as to whether it's fair and equitable and whether we should or shouldn't and how much, if any, we should award to the now ex, soon to be ex-spouse, but the non-member. So we do that in the divorce. After the divorce, we carry on. If the member dies, the OPSRP member dies pre-retirement without remarrying, that benefit goes away. The survivor benefit is gone. However, if the member remarries and then dies, the benefit's there. If the member makes it to retirement, doesn't remarry, the benefit's there. So this is not a new benefit. This is a magic benefit. It really is, because it's a disappearing, reappearing benefit. It exists at the time of vesting. It exists right before the moment of the divorce. It goes away after the divorce. It reappears upon remarriage. It goes away upon another divorce. It's back again on a third marriage. It goes away again on another divorce, but it's back again on retirement. So you can see why this is problematic for both members and judges, because judges are sitting there trying to decide, do I award this thing that may or may not have any benefit? It really depends on what the member does here. Post-divorce, does the member remarry? Does the member die? Does the member make it to retirement? I don't know how to plan for that. So when I, the judge, am dividing up all of the assets and liabilities of these folks and trying to decide on what's equitable, that's nigh impossible to do with this disappearing, reappearing benefit. What Senate Bill 370 does is it enables the court to protect that benefit. So notwithstanding death or remarriage or anything else, that benefit can be awarded to a ex-spouse. This is consistent with PERS Tier 1, PERS Tier 2. It's consistent with all federal pension law covered under ERISA. It's consistent with, frankly, every other retirement plan that I work with other than OPSRP and the City of Portland. And the important thing about this benefit is that it provides consistency and it provides for really what the member and the spouse thought existed. In fact, when you're divorced, there's a form you have to attach to the back of your judgment if you have PERS benefits to say whether the member keeps them all, whether there's a division. And one of the options on the form relating to OPSRP or Tier 1 or Tier 2 is whether to provide a survivor benefit. So the problem is folks think this exists, and in every other plan it does. This is a hole in the law in that it just doesn't make sense for this thing to show up, go away, show up again. So the Oregon State Bar is asking you today to fix that hole, to bring this law in conformance with nearly every other retirement plan, really, other than City of Portland and OPSRP. And to protect this benefit, the real issue is this. And sure, some folks might say, look, people can game the system. You could get married for one day and then divorced, and then boom, you've created this benefit. But let's not look at the folks who may abuse the system. Let's look at the folks who need the system. That's the spouse who's married for 20 years. Divorce in Oregon is not fault-based. You don't have to have a reason to get a divorce. You can say, I don't want to be married anymore. So the member can say, I don't want to be married anymore, and the non-member spouse is out of luck. That benefit existed. And then if that member makes it to retirement, that benefit still exists. But the non-member is powerless to do anything about keeping the benefit that that member was entitled to throughout the marriage, maybe throughout the divorce, depending on if the member remarries, but certainly upon the time of retirement. So this makes sense. And on behalf of the Oregon State Bar, I ask that you move this to the floor. And I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Holvey. My name is Deb Lush. I am a pension expert, a lawyer in town. My partner, Clark Williams, and I, he has already testified in support of this bill. The two of us divide over 500 retirement plans on a yearly basis. We've divided thousands of retirement plans. So we are pretty familiar with the benefits that are provided by various plans. And I can tell you that in our experience, this, as Ryan has described it, sort of disappearing benefit would be illegal under every plan that I know, except for the OPSRP and the City of Portland, the two plans that would be fixed under this patch. This would be illegal under federal law, both with regard to private plans under ERISA, both with regard to the military, the federal employee retirement system, the civil service retirement system. And this law doesn't create a new benefit, but ensures that any existing benefit would still be there, but for the divorce. I know there's some suggestion in the PERS testimony that this would create disparate results under OPSRP and Tier 2, but that's a bit of a red herring. Under OPSRP, this benefit goes away, but for the if the divorce is there. This benefit would be there, but for the divorce. The difference with Tier 2 that's brought up in the testimony is that the benefit is the same whether the divorce has happened before retirement or not. In this case, again, it's an odd circumstance where a benefit exists, but then upon divorce, it disappears. But it could come back and disappear again. So this is what we're hoping to support today, and my recommendation is that you pass this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Steve Rodman. I'm the director of PERS, and I'm sorry, I had to smile with Mr. Carty's characterization. I've heard PERS benefits called many things, but not magic.
Black magic.
So I appreciate a little magic today. I think both of the bill's proponents are certainly accurate in describing the nature of this benefit, and my only purpose here today is to describe to you how the nature of that benefit changes under this bill. Because in 2003, when this legislature created OPSERP, it created a contingent survivor benefit. It says that under the law, the only person who's entitled to a survivor benefit if a member dies before retirement is a surviving spouse and no one else. So children or other relatives, other dependents do not get any benefit out of the OPSERP program if the member dies before retirement. Now, that's for the pension portion of the program. Every OPSERP member is also a member of the individual account program, and their individual contributions go into their account. So the account contributions are similar to the member contributions in Tier 1, Tier 2. There's an account that's there and can be distributed upon death to anyone that the member elects. We're only talking about the pension benefit payable under OPSERP. The concern that we raise is that this bill removes that contingency so that As I think the proponents have characterized, the bill or the benefit does not disappear and reappear. The bill, in fact, stays once the member becomes married and becomes awardable in the divorce. So by removing that contingency, you're going to create circumstances where the benefit is getting paid where it otherwise would not. Because today, I only pay benefits to a surviving spouse of a member who deceases before OBSERP. Now, under this bill, I would have to pay benefits not only to a surviving spouse, but a prior spouse or spouses that this person may have married and divorced throughout the course of their career. I cannot assess for you how many times that's going to happen. I cannot assess for you, therefore, the consequence to the plan and the cost to the plan, because the plan is priced in charging employers to the benefits that we anticipate paying. I really don't have an opportunity. I don't have the data, and I don't think anyone in fairness does, to tell you what the consequence of removing that contingency would mean. Because not only are there the circumstances of the individuals who currently are in the system, but as Mr. Carty pointed out, this creates an opportunity, and we have no idea how many people take advantage of that opportunity, to establish the entitlement to that benefit by getting married and then divorced. And removing that contingency allows people to change their behavior in ways that creates entitlement to a benefit. So to wrap up, my only comment to you, I think, is that I appreciate that there is concern about the adequacy of the OBSERP death benefit. It is only payable to a very narrow group, and that is only to a surviving spouse. We're happy to have a conversation about what the death benefit ought to be provided under OBSERP, as that is the majority of people now in our system. But that, in fairness, should be a comprehensive conversation. The concern about this bill is it addresses a narrow circumstance, but the problem is, even if you are opening a window only narrowly, it's really hard to see what's on the other side of that window. And that's the concern that we're raising here. So with that, Mr. Chair, if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Representative Doherty.
Actually, I have a clarification. You refer to OBSERP. Now, there are three tiers to PERS. Is OBSERP all of it or just Tier 3?
Chair Holvey, Representative Doherty, OBSERP is just the what people call Tier 3, okay. People who have come into the public service since 2003.
Okay. So I just wanted to make that clear, because it's not the entire retirement system. It's just the people that have come into the system since 2003.
And thank you for the clarification, but I think that's the point that they're all, the proponents are also raising, is we have different death benefit structures under Tier 1, Tier 2, and OBSERP. They are different.
Yes. Thank you.
And that was my only point about the individual circumstances. Because the programs are different, the death benefit is necessarily going to depend on the individual's circumstance. We don't have a comprehensive death benefit that's the same for everybody in PERS.
Okay,
and
follow up. So if I was Tier 1 and got divorced, and the divorce decree said I had to give X amount of money to, or X percent to my spouse, and then I die before I retire, but the money would go to that PERS. That was in Tier 1.
Chair Holvey, Representative Doherty, in Tier 1 and Tier 2, the pre-retirement death benefit is your account balance.
Okay.
So for long-serving Tier 1 members, that is substantial, mm-hmm. because they have accumulated contributions and earnings over a long career. I'm a relatively recent Tier 2 member. I came into the system in 2001. I have a very small account balance because I only made contributions for 2 years until they were diverted to the IAP. So I have a relatively small account balance and therefore a relatively meager pre-retirement death benefit that I have available to my spouse, as I keep telling her, get some insurance.
It's small, honey. It's small.
Yeah. So every circumstance is different depending on where you are in the program and what your individual circumstances are.
Thank you very much.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A comment and then a question for Mr. Rodman. I just want to point out to my colleagues, I thought a very useful piece of exhibit in all this, it's labeled Ryan Carty Chart. It has a graph that actually demonstrates visually exactly the kind of situation, narrow situation we're talking about. No offense, I know you did your best trying to explain it, but it's kind of confusing. This chart helped a lot, so thank you for that. Question for Mr. Rodman. I understand that this puts you in a awkward position in terms of you have an inability to gauge what this is going to cost, etc. And I just want to, I guess, push back, but just help understand that, given that you already administer this benefit in the Tier 1 and Tier 2 systems, and given, I guess, assuming they're correct, that essentially every other retirement plan administers this benefit except OPSERP in the city of Portland, didn't that provide at least some basis or some data to try and estimate, like, how frequently this will occur and what it will cost?
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barton, it's a misnomer to say that we administer this benefit in all the programs, because the OPSERP benefit is different than Tier 1, Tier 2. Tier 1, Tier 2 is an account-based death benefit. Tier 1, Tier 2 is half of what the member would get at retirement, which, again, changes over the course of the member's retirement or career. How far away are they from retirement before they die? What is their salary at retirement? All those factors come into play. So it's quite a different matter for me in a Tier 1, Tier 2 situation when all I have to do is write a couple of checks. Mm-hmm. You know, if I have to distribute an account balance to a current spouse, an ex-spouse, and an ex-spouse, I write three checks. Piece of cake. OPSERP pre-retirement death benefit is a continuing benefit that is payable to the surviving spouse currently. I now have to track three recipients. And who's, for example, measuring life do I use? Is it the surviving spouse? And what happens when that spouse dies? Does the benefit continue to the other two? Do I pay them all for as long as each of them may live? They're probably all different ages. So actuarially, I'm going to have a different expectation as to how long those go on. So those are the sorts of conundrums that I have in trying to allocate what is the price of this, removing this contingency from the benefit, and then conveying that cost to employers.
Other questions?
Said I wouldn't, but I actually have one.
You already promised me you weren't asking questions. Representative Widener.
So I'm trying to get a handle on this with the divorce. Isn't everything split at that time, like retirement accounts and everything, when you actually are going into it? Isn't everything done at that time where everything would stop at that point? So whatever they had in OSERP, I mean, whatever that value is, if it's $100,000, it would be $50,000, whatever the judge or the two people agree on. Isn't that what would happen?
Thank you, Chair Holvey, Representative Widener. You're correct that typically what's going to happen is the judge is going to divide everything as of the date of the divorce. The judge doesn't have to do that. The judge can, in every other retirement plan, can provide for a survivor benefit that equals the portion of the marital benefits of the retirement. So you're married for 10 years of the retirement benefits, then you go on and you're divorced for the next 10 years, then the surviving spouse is theoretically going to be entitled to only one half of that first 10 years. And so you can protect that one half of the first 10-year interest and say that the surviving spouse will receive a survivor benefit in the same proportion as the benefits to which that person might have been entitled. The problem is under OPSRP, Tier 3, that we can say the ex-spouse now, the non-member, will be entitled to one half of the marital benefits of the OPSRP plan. The problem being, if the member then dies without remarrying and pre-retirement, then the entitlement goes away entirely. That's the issue that we're trying to protect.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Wouldn't you just cash out at that time? Because that's usually what they do with the retirement plan, is they take it out. They don't wait till retirement or till a death. So wouldn't it just be the value? And then you would just subtract that value of what the account was at the time, and it would go to that spouse?
Right.
So it should happen at the time of divorce.
The problem is that OPSRP does not have a cash balance, whereas PERS Tier 1 and PERS Tier 2 have cash balances. And that's the distinction in terms of Mr. Rodman, he knows today what his death benefit is because he has a specific balance on his Tier 2 account. So when the judge divides and says, I want
not yours, but when the judge divides and says, this is the benefit that I want to award the surviving spouse or the ex-spouse I want to protect, the judge knows exactly what it'll be. So it's problematic with OPSRP because it does change. You cannot divide it because there's no cash balance, and then it may go away, come back, go away, come back.
And if I may, Mr. Carty's characterizing it correctly. I think the nature of the problem is, of course, that without this bill at that time of divorce, the judge has nothing to award because it's a contingent benefit. So you may have put in 10 years in marriage to a person who is an OPSRP member, and there is a benefit at retirement that is a survivor benefit that can be awarded. But we're only talking about that gap between the time of divorce and the actual retirement. Should the member die in that gap, there's a contingency on that benefit that currently that there would be a surviving spouse at that time. And this bill removes that contingency and gives the judge something else of an asset that can be divided.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just one question. What if the ex-spouse remarries? Is there any, does she then still get the retirement if he dies?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, you mean in the current law?
And we're talking about Tier 1, I think. So if they get divorced, the ex-spouse gets remarried, he dies before retirement, does she get any of his retirement?
So under the current law in Tier 1, as I say, there's an account basis that can be awarded at the divorce. So if the member dies before retirement, then the ex-spouse can get the awarded portion of that account.
Regardless of if she gets remarried or
he or she gets remarried or whatever, unless the decree gets amended. I mean, it all depends on how the decree is crafted at the time that the divorce occurs.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I really appreciate you bringing the bill forward. With that, Mr. Livingston.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. We're neutral on the bill, but a couple of comments that I'd like to put on the record regarding this particular policy issue that is in front of you is the first point is that there are plans outside of OPSRT and PERS that are there that certainly some of my members belong to under what is referred to as equal to or better. This bill would perhaps have a potential impact on those particular plans. Certainly, Mr. Rodeman, he does the analysis to determine whether those plans meet the guidelines under an equal to or better plan, but certainly doesn't have the analysis of what impact they may have. I think that's a policy implication that this body has to address at some point in time, and I simply don't have that information. The second point that I would make is clearly having had the privilege of representing the firefighters for now 20 years in this building, and as a firefighter myself, right, wrong, or indifference, anything dealing with pensions, whether it's OPS or PERS, there is a level of complexity into that. Clearly, over my 20 years in this building, each time the legislature has addressed these types of issues and tried to say, hey, we're going to fix this, there has been, on more than one occasions, implications for that. And so what I would suggest to you is simply by the debate and some of the discussions that took on the disparities between the death benefits and these issues, there's a lot of those that are still outstanding that need to be addressed. And so perhaps one of the things that may be something to consider is while, again, we're neutral on this bill, I do think that there are a lot of outstanding issues and some issues that may come. And the final point that I would make is while this bill deals with a dissolution of a marriage and that kind of situation, I think we're all cognizant of where that there's a Supreme Court decision that, you know, is going to come down in June and that perhaps will have ramifications and implications on not just PERS and OPSRPs, but on many pension benefit plans. And so I just think that, one, if you elect to go forward with this bill, I think It's a hard, complex issue, and something that I know our members are trying to get their hands around, and something that just, I think, caution would be the word that I would use as you look at this bill and contemplate what to do. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions? Mr. Livingston, thank you for your words of caution. Was there anyone else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 370? Seeing none, I'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 370 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 580.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure has many provisions. First, enables the Oregon Landscape Contractors Board, that's the LCB, to assess contested case proceedings costs to persons requesting a claim against the LCB up to $5,000 in claims hearings costs. Allows a consumer to file claims with both the LCB and the Construction Contractors Board if the landscape business is licensed by both. Permits the LCB licensed business to subcontract work relating to landscaping jobs to a general or specialty contractor. Clarifies that maintenance of work remains unregulated and that the LCB licensees have the right to repair what they are qualified to install. Clarifies that LCB licensees may install artificial turf except in large sports fields. Allows LCB licensed professional to plan irrigation systems. For landscape professionals, increases the insurance requirements to $500,000 and increases the bond requirement for landscaping jobs that are for $50,000 or more, extends to 30 days the time an LCB licensee has to provide their notice of address change, allows the landscaping work that is under $2,000 to be performed without a written contract, expands the activities that a business may perform regarding ornamental water features, drainage and irrigation, fences, decks, arbors, patios, edging, driveways, walkways, retaining walls, and finally provides the LCB the discretion regarding whether to assess penalties for law violations and impose license sanctions, allowing LCB employees or the administrator of LCB to issue a stop work order on behalf of the board. There are no amendments. The Senate vote was 29-0.
Thank you. And we have Senate Bill Kim Gladwell
Raleigh,
Lisa Walter Sedluck, and Elizabeth Rimley. Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Kim Gladwell Rowley, and I'm the program manager for the Landscape Contractors Board. And I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 580 and give you a little background on it. After the 2013 legislative session, Senator Thompson convened a work group to discuss the agency, the laws and rules. The stakeholders that were involved in that group were the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, Southern Oregon Landscape Association, water purveyors, the Oregon League of Cities, Oregon Landscape Association, the CCB, several self-representing licensees, the board staff, and a representative from the board. What came out of that group is Senate Bill 580. It was a collaborative effort. I won't go over all the highlights, like Jan has already mentioned several of them, but I'll mention a few of them. Right now, the law does not allow a consumer to file a claim or the board to accept a claim if the licensee is also licensed with the Construction Contractors Board. And so this cleans that up. It also increases the insurance requirement from $100,000 to $500,000 and requires a new $20,000 bond for landscape jobs over $50,000. And the last thing that it does that's important is that it adds bond coverage for tree work. So we at the LCB do not regulate tree work other than installation of trees. The CCB regulates tree work. In their law, there's an exemption for LCB licensees to do tree work, but the bond does not cover it. This would allow the bond to cover that work. That's all I had.
Thank you. Would you like to provide some testimony?
Yes.
Good morning. My name is Lisa Walters-Hedlasek. I'm here as a representative of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. I currently serve on the board, and I am in the legislative group. I am also the owner and operator of a landscape company in Florence, Oregon. I have served on the Landscape Contractors Board for 6 years and then was part of this task group. Over the years, we have watched the landscaping industry evolve, and we have watched certain things change, and this task group addressed those issues that we feel will help protect the consumer and make better law. When our statutes were written, landscaping was much more simple. There wasn't artificial turf. There wasn't outdoor kitchens. There wasn't low-voltage lighting. Those things have all come into place over the 26 years that I've been a landscape contractor. As the landscaper's law stand right now, I cannot perform any work for any customer without a written contract. A customer has a main line on his irrigation break. I cannot go fix it legally without a written contract, unless we can get that kind of either an email or something like that. This law fixes that problem. It allows me to do work up to $2,000 without a written contract. And that was a really important thing for people to be able to do business. It also will allow me to subcontract to the CCB. I go to put in a low-voltage light transformer. I cannot legally subcontract to an electrician to put that device on. But so then I have to have that person go and have a separate contract with the consumer. The consumer doesn't understand this relationship. They just want one contract. This way I can subcontract to an electrician, to a plumber, and then the contract covers it, our bonds cover it, and we all are legally licensed. The other thing is that it would allow me to, for example, right now, I can put in a garden fence, but I cannot go back and replace a board if it breaks 2 years later. I'm not allowed to maintain things. There are just those little things that were in the law that we had found and addressed, and people have complained about over the years, and consumers have been upset. And this bill, we feel, really helps have a better law that is better for consumer protection. As a member of the OLCA board and as a small business owner and contractor, I really urge your vote for this bill. We feel it's a wonderful collaborative effort and deals with lots of the issues that have surfaced over the years. Thank you.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Nurseries. The OAN has several members who are landscapers, and we have overlapping membership with OLCA. We really appreciate the collaborative work that went into crafting this cleanup bill, and we think that it's going to make lives a lot easier for those who are planting the plants that our nursery members grow. So we appreciate your support of this. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Ms. Grabe, would you like to testify?
No. Our letter is on the record. I think it's fine.
So just to note, a committee, the Oregon State Bar, has a letter on this subject as well. And I'm trying to see if it was actually in opposition or not.
Yes, she'll testify.
Yes, she
will. I'd just like to try to clarify whether your letter is in opposition to this bill or not.
Susan Grabe, on behalf of the Oregon State Bar, the administrative law section of the Oregon State Bar submitted a letter of testimony in to raise a concern about the legislation, not just the legislation before you today, but in general, state licensing boards always or typically have provisions in them that shift the cost to the licensee if they proceed in any contested case hearing. And they have a concern about that, a philosophical concern about that. So they have submitted a letter of concern. They don't have any issue with the substance of the underlying bill in general, but they do have a concern about that provision being inserted in legislation across the board.
Thank you. With that I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 580. Going to recess for about 3 minutes.
It's all they got to do is go online and get it.
I'd like to reconvene the House Committee on Business and Labor. And before I forget it, I'm going to go to the back of the page on my agenda and open up a work session on Senate Bill 491A.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure we heard on May 13th. It directs DAS to establish a pay equity training program, prohibits a public contracting agency from contracting with a bidder who employs 50 or more full-time workers on a state contract that exceeds $500,000 unless the bidder possesses a certificate indicating that they've completed the pay equity training program offered through DAS. There are no amendments, and the Senate was a vote of 30-0. There is no revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
So if I could have somebody from DAS come up just really quickly. Committee, I did have someone who came forward with a little bit of concern about who was actually going to be required to take the training. I believe we discussed that in the committee, and whether or not it actually had to be put into the statute. After reviewing it, it appeared that this is something that should be taken care of in rules, and I think it was largely put on record. But for those purposes, thank you.
Certainly. Good morning, Chair Holby, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Madeline Zeich. I'm the Chief Human Resources Officer at DAS. And for the record, DAS will be working in rulemaking to address who will take the training as well as the timing of the training. And we've already started developing some of those training modules, as we'll be using those in the executive branch to train some of our hiring managers also.
Thank you with that. I have a motion.
Chair Holby, I move Senate Bill 491A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Barton moves Senate Bill 491A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none. Matthew, could we have a roll call, please?
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Excused.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Byrd?
Excused.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kinnemer?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 491A, having received the votes, is passed. Volunteers to carry the bill. Training programs, I guess I'll do it. Thanks a lot.
Representative Hurd volunteers.
I think I heard that too.
So with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 491A, and we will open up a work session on Senate Bill 370A. Representative Barton, do you have a motion?
Chair Holby, I move Senate Bill 378 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Sworn. Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 378 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. I will note that I appreciate the caution from PERS and everyone else, but I do see a particular inequity in this approach to ex-surviving spouses in this, and I think that inequity needs to be corrected. I also think that I would like PERS to keep track of this, you know, so that they will have the data to in the future to come back to us and tell us about the impacts, because I don't think they'll ever be able to tell us ahead of time what the impacts of this situation will be. So we will take that venture into the future. Should this bill pass through the rest of the session. Representative Doherty.
I'm supportive of this bill, and the reason is that with the three tiers of PERS, the other two tiers, this is not affected, but it's just with the third, the way that the third one is structured. So it's one of those things that's fair. I mean, if a divorce decree says the ex-spouse gets X, but because of the way that it's currently structured, that goes away, is it makes it much simpler. So it's just kind of aligning it with the rest of the PERS system.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, I'll be a yes vote, provided I don't have to carry it, because I'd be worried I'd have to explain the bill.
Boy, that was dangerous.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it was.
Mr. Chair, I'll be a no vote, so I'd like to have lots of questions to the carrier.
So with that, Matthew, can we have a roll call?
Representative Beretta?
No.
Aye.
Representative Escobar?
Excused.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Megan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Excused.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Martin?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kimmer?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. That's Bill 370. Having received the votes, it's passed. Is to volunteer to carry the bill. Thank you, Margaret.
Yes. Thank you, Margaret.
With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 378.
I don't have a PERS retirement, so my former husband got my real retirement.
Perfect carrier. With that, I'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 937.
Committee members, this is the measure that prohibits the retail sale of powdered alcohol. There are no amendments, and there's no revenue, there's no fiscal impact, and the Senate vote was 29-1.
Representative Barton.
Chair Hovey, I move Senate Bill 937 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 937 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Evans.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, I'm probably going to be a yes on this, but I want to be very clear that I'm nervous about doing this at the same time we're legalizing marijuana. And a friend of mine told me recently that consistency is something that is not always going on in politics, but philosophically, I'm struggling with this particular measure. So just wanted that on the record.
Mr. Chair, I will go on this. I have actually got to watch some videos, see some different things, and investigated the powder alcohol because I understood the concern and everything with it. And there is really no possible way someone can snort this, an OD from it. The amount that you would have to take even to make a drink, I mean, it just sits in the top. It cakes up. It tastes nasty. It's easier to take a shot of alcohol and put it into someone's glass to spike a drink just because the pure size of what it takes in this powdered alcohol. So the federal government legalized it. I trust the FDA in doing this. I am a no on this. I think it's something that for that rare occasion that you want to backpack and have a nasty drink out in the woods, I guess let somebody have a nasty drink. I think it would cure somebody from drinking, because after watching the guy do this, it was awful.
Thank you. Appreciate your comments. Other comments? Thank you. Matthew, can we have a roll call, please?
Representative Beretta?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Escobar?
Excused.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Bird?
Excused.
Representative Nuss?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kennemer?
Aye.
Chair Holden?
Aye. Senate Bill 937, having received the votes, is passed. Volunteers to carry the bill? Guys are killing me.
We love you, Mr. Chair.
I will, Mr. Chair.
I will. I'll carry the bill.
Fagan offered to.
I'll carry.
Yeah. Representative Fagan will carry the bill. Increases its options. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 937 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 272.
Committee members, this is the measure that modifies the powers of the Board of Accountancy and provides regulations for accountants reflecting best practices in the Uniform Accountancy Act. There were no amendments, there is no revenue, there's a minimal fiscal impact, and the Senate vote was 30-0.
Thank you. Can I have a motion, please?
Chair Hovey, I move Senate Bill 272 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 272 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Matt, can we have a roll call, please?
President Beretta?
Aye.
President Dougal?
Aye.
President Lesko?
Excused.
President Evans?
Yes.
President Fagan?
Yes.
President Byrd?
Excused.
President Nose?
Yes.
President Weider?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 272, having received the votes, is passed. Representative Barton will carry the bill.
Cool.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 272 and open a work session on Senate Bill 138A.
This is a measure that allows a brew pub licensee to distribute malt beverages manufactured by the licensee to other premises under its same ownership and for export. Increases the amount of malt beverage that the brew pub licensee can sell at wholesale and distribute to OLC licensees to 7,500 barrels. There's no amendments, there's no revenue, there's no fiscal, and the vote on the Senate was 29-1.
Chair Hovey, I move Senate Bill 138A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 138A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Evans.
I'm just volunteering to carry the bill.
I haven't asked that question yet.
Carry the bill.
Right. Saving me some time.
Yes, sir.
And no other discussion. Matthew, can we have a roll call, please?
Representative Beretta?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Excused.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Byrd?
Excused.
Representative Dose?
Aye.
Representative Weider?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cameron?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 138, having received the votes, is passed. Representative Evans will carry the bill.
Thank you.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 138A. And we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 582A.
This is a measure that provides credit unions may pay their directors and supervisory committee members reasonable compensation, removes requirement to open a share account as a condition of membership, allows persons within the field of membership to become a member based upon the credit relationship or on a payment of membership fee, repeals a requirement that any credit union that provides membership to employees at the State of Union include foster parents in its fields of membership, modifies definitions of immediate family, removes requirement for credit union to apply and a pay fee to the Department of Consumer Business Services to open new branches, and finally requires 30-day notification to DCBS for opening new branches. There are no amendments, there's no revenue, there's no fiscal, and the Senate vote was 29-0.
Chair Hovey, I move Senate Bill 582A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Barton moves Senate Bill 582A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Matthew, can we have a roll call?
President Beretta?
Aye.
President Doherty?
Aye.
President Esquivel?
Excused.
President Evans?
Yes.
President Fagan?
Yes.
President Byrd?
Excused.
President Nose?
Aye.
President Weider?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenneberg?
Aye.
Chair Holden?
Aye. Senate Bill 582, having received the votes, is passed. Volunteers, carry the bill. Okay. Representative Kinnemer, thank you.
I will.
Oh, you want to carry this over?
Mm-hmm.
And that one you're not carrying over?
All right.
And we worked that one earlier.
So that's the complete agenda. So with that, committee, I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 580A. We'll repost it for work session today. The rest of the agenda is complete for today. Thank you very much for being here a little bit extra longer. With that, I adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. Have a great Memorial Day weekend.
Thank you, Mark.
Memorial Day weekend.